Hello, and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the July 4th to July 10th edition of the magazine, plus the seventh and final chapter of the America at 250 series. On the cover this week, an illustration of a great big red, white, blue, and gold birthday cake, with, presumably, 250 candles about to be lit. The headline, America at 250. The cover leader, America is anxious and awesomely powerful. Restlessness is what prevents the Republic from sinking into stagnation. After that, we'll have four additional leaders, starting with Rules for Supermodels. America should not imprison frontier AI. Fable is free, but the technology desperately needs better regulations. Then, pipe down and pipe oil. Turkey and Israel should trade energy, not insults. Both have much to gain from being less belligerent. Then, Venezuela's wretched response. Venezuela's earthquakes are partly America's problem. The government's response has been dire. Its patron has a duty to help. And finally, an admission. We was wrong about oil. The market bested us. But for The Economist, there is no shame in that. And then after that, we will go to Chapter 7 of the America at 250 series, Hope, Backlash, and the Battle for America, 2006 to present. So, back to the top we go for the cover leader. America is anxious and awesomely powerful. Restlessness is what prevents the Republic from sinking into stagnation. From the start, 250 years ago, America's founders believed that their Republic would shine out as an example to all humanity. But the Republic was also an experiment, and they feared that it could soon collapse into disorder or tyranny. Such has been the dance throughout America's extraordinary history. Slavery and xenophobia, corruption and robber barons, civil war and world war have all jostled the Republic, even as America rose to become the beacon of the free world. On July 4th, Americans are celebrating their semiquincentennial. All those syllables rebut the founders' gloom. Far from succumbing to tyranny, America saved the world from tyrants three times over. Glorious disorder created a dynamism that has long sustained America as a superpower. Dominance comes with temptations, but the United States has, by and large, held out Republican virtues as the salvation of people everywhere. Yet, this birthday comes at another anxious moment in America's story. Virtue is under threat, and talk of decline is in the air. Even as citizens celebrate together, public life is scarred by division. America is demolishing the world order that it created after the defeat of fascism in 1945. The restless Republic is opening a new chapter. But does that signal retreat, as some Americans worry, or instead herald a renewal? To understand this moment, and to mark the 250th anniversary, The Economist retraced the steps of Alexis de Tocqueville, a French aristocrat whose tour of the country in the early 1830s furnished the material for Democracy in America, a trove of enduring insights into the Republic. If you listen to our podcast, you will discover that many Americans today echo the founders' fears. They worry that the separation of powers is degenerating into a White House-takes-all world. Congress was meant to be the leading branch of government, but it is gripped by a vicious partisanship in which, quote, we are right and, quote, they are bad. To pass laws requires give and take, but the parties punish compromise, and gerrymandering rewards extreme views. The Supreme Court is adding to the might of the executive. This week, though it struck down one of the president's schemes over birthright citizenship, it also expanded his power by ruling that he can sack officials in federal agencies. A nation of immigrants, The United States has, at its best, treated the people flocking to its shores as a source of vitality and a validation of the American dream. China has a dream, too, but foreigners are excluded by the unalterable fact that they were not born Chinese. By contrast, people of any race or faith can become American. Their welcome is the promise that what they and their children can accomplish is limited only by their imagination and capacity for hard work. But the American dream has soured. Bits of the MAGA movement want to shut down legal immigration, not just the illegal sort. This year, net migration could be zero, as the share of Americans who call themselves white sinks towards 50%. Some on the right want to give a special status to, quote, heritage Americans, whose forebears have been in the country for generations. This is an ugly throwback to the racism that America's rejected as part of the moral and material progress that best define the Republic's success. Abroad, America is also retreating from its values. As our essay this week describes, Donald Trump is leading a wrecking ball revolution to smash the institutions and alliances that the post-war generation set up to keep the world safe from despotism. He and many Americans on the right and left feel contempt for a global system that they blame, misguidedly in the view of The Economist, for aiding China, punishing America's workers, and sending its young soldiers to spill their blood in far-off countries. Accordingly, America is throwing its weight around like any other country chasing wealth and power. Freedom and democracy for foreigners are off the agenda. Trade used to be a system of mutual benefit. It has become a tool for extracting concessions. Shared values once united America and its allies. Now, allies are seen as dependents to be exploited. Many people conclude that America is in decline. That strikes this newspaper as a grave misreading. America's power is immense, and it could be about to grow beyond all recognition. For evidence of the country's unabated dynamism, look outside its dysfunctional politics. America's artificial intelligence companies have rapidly mobilized hundreds of billions of dollars to finance the pursuit of a technological lead. If, as they predict, AI changes everything, then America and its AI stack may become utterly dominant, for a time at least. Some of that is bound to rub off on America's businesses and its formidable armed forces. Its allies, however much they have been antagonized by Mr. Trump, would face a bleak choice between submitting to America or siding with authoritarian China. As America amasses awesome power, the great experiment could go disastrously wrong. Mr. Trump has tainted public life with an ugly cynicism that always sees the worst in everyone. Boosted by AI-enhanced agencies, executive power could become overwhelming. The concentration of wealth and political power could foster a predatory elite. Partisanship, fanned by social media, gerrymandering, and party primaries dominated by zealots, could become further entrenched. Politicians might prove unable to deal with the economic and social upheaval that lies ahead. As domestic politics grows dirtier and nastier, America could also become more predatory abroad. Imagine that its abandonment of the project to promote liberty is permanent. Other countries will copy it. Violent, ambitious leaders will feel emboldened to conquer or coerce their neighbors. The world will descend into chaos. However, as the founders would attest, that dark future is not certain, or even likely. The corollary of America's dynamism is its capacity for reinvention. Episodes that set the Republic back, Pearl Harbor, Sputnik, Watergate, spurred it to recover and charge ahead. Roused, Americans set about making sure the next time they would do better and be better. One way or another, change is coming to America, because too much today is unsustainable. The social contract, which is financed by borrowing, is fiscally unsustainable. Mr. Trump's generation is biologically unsustainable. His successor will belong to a new, younger group of Americans. The hope must be that voters will decide that the two parties' sterile mutual contempt has become politically unsustainable, too. As celebratory fireworks light up cities and towns across America, remember that restlessness is precisely what prevents the Republic from sinking into stagnation. All those arguments and fights are a precondition for the creative destruction that precedes the nation's renewal. Naturally, the founders would be worried today, just as they were 250 years ago. Yet their revolutionary insight was to build their great experiment on the wisdom of the people. Time and again, that faith has been richly rewarded. That was the cover leader. America is anxious and awesomely powerful. Restlessness is what prevents the Republic from sinking into stagnation. And we'll proceed now to leader article number 2. Rules for supermodels. America should not imprison frontier AI. Fable is free, but the technology desperately needs better regulations. New rules often come out of disasters. America's Federal Reserve was founded following the Panic of 1907, when stock prices fell by half. Pressure from muckrakers such as Upton Sinclair brought about the Food and Drug Administration. The Securities and Exchange Commission was founded during the Great Depression. Artificial intelligence has not yet caused a calamity, but it might. Models like Anthropic's Mythos and OpenAI's GPT 5.6 Sol are extraordinarily good hackers and could become capable advisors to bioterrorists. Understandably, the Trump administration is trying to regulate the technology before catastrophe strikes. It is working with AI companies on voluntary standards that could soon be released. Unfortunately, its efforts so far have been a mess. Anthropic was its first victim, slapped with export controls in mid-June after the release of Fable, a guardrailed version of Mythos. That came not long after a row between the company and the Pentagon. Fears of a grudge were allayed when the administration appeared to compel OpenAI to limit access to its Sol model. Then, on June 30th, the Commerce Department abruptly lifted the ban on Fable after Anthropic fiddled with its safety protections. Throughout, the government has seemed to make up rules on the fly. Its decisions have also had an unpleasant nationalistic tinge. At first, it restricted Fable only for non-Americans. Anthropic decided that a wholesale block was the only way to comply. It looks as if the administration pulled the only lever available, knowing that it was a de facto ban. But throughout the past month's brouhaha, the government has made clear that Americans' AI access takes precedence over foreigners. Now that America has started licensing AI releases, it is unlikely to stop. But regulating frontier AI is tricky. China's top models are only months behind America's, and most are open weight, meaning anyone can run or tinker with them. One recent release, GLM 5.2 from Z.AI, already matches the best of the last generation of American models. Chinese labs may take longer to catch up with Mythos, since they have fewer chips and American labs are cracking down on distillation when competitors use the outputs of the best models to train their own. But that buys months, or a year at most. America could ban Chinese open-weight models and punish foreigners who use them. But even if it managed to enforce its ban, a vast home market would keep China's model makers going. So a permanent block is unworkable. It is also undesirable. Many American AI firms and researchers rely on Chinese models, which are cheap and malleable. The intelligence that makes new models dangerous also makes them tremendously useful. Worries about China aside, a gulf between publicly available and restricted models is a problem. Societies adapt to AI best when improvements arrive gradually, not in a great lurch. Imagine the mess if regulators bottled up several generations of mythos-style advances. The few with access would acquire great power. The sudden jump in capability whenever the models did get released would unleash chaos. How, then, can models like Mythos and Soul be safely set free? The emerging norm provides for an evaluation period and a staggered release to trusted institutions. That is a good start, but it needs formalizing. Some choices, such as how much risk to tolerate, belong to elected leaders. But politicians should not be micromanaging the process or horse trading with AI companies as they do today. Once those goals are set, politicians should stand back. Evaluating a model is a technical problem. Governments have some expertise, for example, in America's Center for AI Standards and Innovation, or Britain's AI Security Institute, or AISI. But the private sector has more. The finance and electric power industries offer structures where oversight is carried out by industry bodies, overseen by government. Something similar might help amalgamate knowledge from the AI labs, research groups, and foreign bodies, such as AISI. Ideally, America would work with its allies on AI regulation. Alas, it is hard to imagine Donald Trump giving up the immense sovereign power that stems from control of frontier models. Locking others out of AI is not in America's economic or strategic interest, but neither were indiscriminate tariffs or threats to Greenland. So other countries must build leverage with their own AI sectors and regulations and find fail-safes for American export controls. They could, for instance, ensure that businesses can easily switch to non-American models that run on non-American data centers. It is far wiser to depend on America than on China, but they would be mad to ignore the risks. That was Leader Article Number 2, Rules for Supermodels. America should not imprison frontier AI. Fable is free, but the technology desperately needs better regulations. And we proceed now to Leader Article Number 3. Pipe down and pipe oil. Turkey and Israel should trade energy, not insults. Both have much to gain from being less belligerent. A minister in Turkey has spoken of one day, quote, ruling Jerusalem. Israeli officials have warned darkly that Turkey is, quote, the new Iran. Listen to the volleys of invective flying in both directions, and you might think that two of the Middle East's pivotal powers are heading for conflict. The tension is real. Turkey, a mostly Muslim country, fumes over Israel's ill treatment of Palestinians. Israel accuses Turkey of harboring leaders of Hamas, the Islamist group that attacked Israel on October 7, 2023. Each thinks the other threatens its borders. Israel has fostered ties with Kurds, including some that Turkey's government, ever wary of Kurdish nationalism, see as enemies. Turkey has close relations with the ex-jihadists now ruling Syria, who appear to be reformed, but who Israeli fears could one day prove hostile to the Jewish state. Israel's prime minister and Turkey's president often swap ferocious insults. Benjamin Netanyahu recently called Recep Tayyip Erdogan an, quote, anti-Semitic dictator who is, quote, committing genocide against the Kurds. Then again, Mr. Erdogan has likened the Israeli leader to Hitler, saying Israel is a chaos factory fueled, quote, by blood and tears. Such rhetoric gets attention abroad, but it is mostly intended for domestic ears. Mr. Netanyahu faces a tough election in the autumn and fears that he will lose office, having been cast as the man who failed his people on October 7th. Mr. Erdogan may lean on Turkey's parliament to call an election next year. Each loves to pose as a doughty defender of the nation against external threats. Each is thus a handy foil for the other. It does not have to be this way. Both countries are allies of America, which is, belatedly, trying to discourage the verbal salvos. Not long ago, the armed forces of Israel and Turkey were able to cooperate. In the recent past, it was possible to imagine healthy economic ties, too. Their respective industrial and technological strengths and physical proximity should have made that straightforward. Given the right politics, how might a better relationship be fostered again? Energy may be the key. Despite an embargo Mr. Erdogan's government imposed on trade with Israel in 2024, much of the oil Israel imports is pumped in Azerbaijan or the Kurdish region of Iraq, and then transported by pipeline through Turkey or shipped through Ceyhan, a Turkish port. More should follow. Given Iran's ability to disrupt the flow of hydrocarbons through the Strait of Hormuz, other countries should develop alternative sources and supply routes. One rich possibility is gas in the eastern Mediterranean. Exploration there by Israel is already advanced. It should be open to joint projects with Turkey and other littoral states to develop subsea gas fields and export the energy they find there. When Israel and Turkey worked together more closely, plans were drawn for a pipeline to connect the eastern Mediterranean gas fields to Turkey's southern ports. A related project would be to forge a regional network of pipelines to bring oil and gas from afar more easily to market. Israel and Turkey should both aspire to be a part of this network, linking Gulf producers and others to buyers in Europe and Asia. It is still not clear when, or even if, the Strait of Hormuz will be fully reopened to tanker traffic, at least without users paying fees to Iran and perhaps Oman. If Israel and Turkey want to reduce their vulnerability to the regional rogue, and maybe make a large heap of money in the process, they should trade fewer barbs and more barrels. That was Leader Article Number 3, Pipe Down and Pipe Oil. Turkey and Israel should trade energy, not insults. Both have much to gain from being less belligerent. And we'll turn now to Leader Article Number 4, Venezuela's Wretched Response. Venezuela's earthquakes are partly America's problem. The government's response has been dire. Its patron has a duty to help. The earthquakes that struck Venezuela on June 24th killed more than 2,000 people by the official count. Many more are listed as missing, and the UN has ordered 10,000 body bags. But the true toll will probably never be known. After decades of brutal kleptocracy, Venezuela is no longer the kind of country where bodies are properly counted. The regime's response to the disaster has been dismal. In La Guaira, the worst-hit state, survivors say no official help came in the first 48 hours, the crucial period when there is the best chance that people trapped under fallen buildings might still be breathing. Families were left to scrabble for their loved ones in heaps of dust and broken concrete. Heavy machinery for moving the rubble was slow to come and sometimes lacked fuel. Some rescue teams had no torches. The stench of rotting corpses is now pervasive. injured survivors who make it to hospital find the wards short-staffed and ill-equipped. The regime, which is as incompetent as it is authoritarian, has been slow to distribute aid. Since January, when Donald Trump sent military forces to capture Venezuela's dictator, Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's problems have become America's, too. President Trump replaced Mr. Maduro with his more biddable deputy, Delcy Rodriguez, and has boasted that he now runs the country through her. That is an exaggeration, but America does directly control Venezuela's oil revenues, and Ms. Rodriguez must, to some degree, cooperate with Uncle Sam if she wishes to avoid her predecessor's fate. He is stuck in an American prison. America's unique involvement in Venezuela brings unique responsibilities. It should do more to fulfill them. About 300 American rescuers have arrived, along with 900 Marines. But of $300 million promised in aid, only $100 million is new money. All help is welcome, but the need is great. Meanwhile, other challenges are looming. Venezuela's most popular politician, the opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, is in exile. The Trump administration has told her not to try to return for fear that her arrival in Caracas would spark unrest. Until now, she has complied. But after the quakes, she is understandably desperate to get back to her people. In the past week, America and the regime have blocked her. That is wrong. As a Venezuelan, she has a right to go home. Elections have been promised, but many fear the regime will keep delaying them. Fury is building. Mr. Trump's popularity in Venezuela, sky high just after he removed the hated Mr. Maduro, has been falling. This is a dangerous mix. An election may not be feasible soon, but America and the regime should set a timetable for one. That might assuage public anger. It might also give foreign investors hope that the country will one day be less lawless and hence more worth investing more in. The earthquakes have aggravated another huge challenge, the mess that is the government's debts. By one estimate, Venezuela's sovereign debt adds up to $240 billion, or 240% of GDP. If that is accurate, a restructuring would be the most ambitious ever attempted anywhere. Worse, the IMF, which is normally a neutral arbiter, is not involved, and the mix of creditors includes Chinese banks, Russia's government, and others who choose to remain anonymous. American officials say they hope a deal can be struck by the end of the year, but that sounds fanciful. America must not accept a partial botched agreement merely to stay on schedule. That would be open to legal challenge and accusations of corruption. To give Venezuela its best shot at stable finances, America must instead press its government to stick to international rules and engage with the IMF. Even if it takes longer. For the thousands crushed or smothered by the quakes, it is too late. For Venezuela, there is a chance of renewal, but they deserve better than Mr. Trump and his dire protege. That was leader number 4, Venezuela's wretched response. Venezuela's earthquakes are partly America's problem. The government's response has been dire. Its patron has a duty to help. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program, featuring articles from the July 4th to July 10th edition of the magazine, plus Chapter 7 of the America at 250 series. And we'll return now to Leader Article Number 5, the last one in this issue. An admission. We was wrong about oil. The market bested us. But for The Economist, there is no shame in that. An editor of The Economist once said, quote, "We are a paper of opinion and views. we stick our neck out and consequently risk having it chopped from time to time. The oil price has delivered such a blow. At the end of April, almost 2 months after America and Israel attacked Iran, we said oil traders were in la-la land, thinking that oil prices would fall to $88 by the end of the year. Today, Brent crude costs just over $70 a barrel. Our prediction went about as well as the war. We got it wrong for two reasons. First, we thought that America and Iran would hold out against a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. America, because Mr. Trump deludedly thought he held the whip hand. Iran, because its regime knew its people could be made to endure more pain. In fact, facing the fury of American motorists, Mr. Trump all but folded, preventing a disaster. Since the two parties struck a provisional deal in June, enough oil has been getting out of the Gulf to reassure markets that supply is coming back online, even if the future of the Strait remains uncertain. Our second oversight was, like others, not anticipating the staggering degree to which China would be able to slash its oil imports. Crude imports are 5 million barrels a day lower than a year ago, despite the fall in prices. China has cut its demand and shored up supply. Its oil reserves are opaque. Many barrels are hidden from satellites underground, and there is a blurred line between official reserves and corporate inventories. But they have been shown to be a powerful buffer. Perhaps a newspaper whose critics bang on about a clangor in 1999, when we wrongly predicted oil prices falling to $5 a barrel, should have known better. We was wrong then, too. Fortunately, we can report that investors who say we are a guide to what to bet against are cherry-picking our failures. With the help of AI, we analyzed 7,000 of this century's leaders. When we are moderately out of consensus, our record is good. Our more outlandish predictions are, unsurprisingly, more likely to be wrong. In any case, as free traders, we take a strange satisfaction in being bested by the markets. It is a reminder that the price of an asset in a liquid market is the closest thing there is to the distilled judgment of humanity. Prices incorporate information dispersed unevenly among countless individuals, from the amateur investor to Europe's high-rolling oil traders. The market is not always right, and did not expect oil prices to fall as much as they did. But to think that with average luck anyone can reliably do better is to commit an error akin to that of central planners who think they can allocate resources better than the price mechanism can. Why, then, have an opinion at all? Prediction markets cover an increasing range of events, making it easier than ever to see how the market views the future. Yet, someone who reflexively substitutes the market's opinion for their own will not know why they believe what they believe. The case for prediction is therefore like the case for free speech. Well-argued opinions sharpen the thinking of those who read them, even when they are wrong. Without such views, there would be nothing to aggregate into a market price. So we will keep on predicting. In so doing, we also hope to spare our readers a great deal of drudgery. The easiest way not to be wrong is to avoid taking any definite view at all, an approach that makes many bureaucratic reports joy-slayingly dull. We read these reports so you don't have to, a service for which the occasional blunder is, we hope, a price worth paying. Sorry for our mistake. It will happen again. That was Leader Article Number 5, an admission. We was wrong about oil. The market bested us, but for the economist, there is no shame in that. And we'll move on now to the seventh and final chapter of the America at 250 series. Hope, Backlash, and the Battle for America, 2006 to the present. Too Big to Fail, 2006 to 2009. In August 2006, we called America's housing market, quote, the biggest bubble in American history. Not boasting, just stating facts. Remember, we're British. But even we could not imagine the cataclysmic events to come. Cheap credit and aggressive lending to high-risk or, quote, subprime borrowers were fueling demand, driving up house prices. Banks were bundling these risky mortgages into complex securities, obscuring the underlying risk. In 2007, when house prices dropped, many borrowers defaulted. Mortgage-backed securities suddenly lost value, hitting banks hard. In March 2008, Bear Stearns, America's fifth largest investment bank, collapsed. 6 months later, Lehman Brothers, the fourth largest, filed for bankruptcy. The financial system seemed on the verge of unraveling. To restore confidence, the Bush administration proposed a $700 billion bailout, largely aimed at financial institutions deemed, quote, too big to fail. Republicans and Democrats somehow worked together to pass the measure and rescue the financial system. But the crisis still triggered the worst global recession since the Great Depression. Many Americans wondered whom the political elites cared most about protecting, a question that would reverberate through the country's politics until the present day. The meaning of Obama, 2008 to 2016. On November 4, 2008, nearly four centuries after the first enslaved Africans arrived in the colony of Virginia, America elected Barack Obama, its first black president. His victory reflected an increasingly diverse nation. Some 96% of blacks thought it would improve race relations. We declared, quote, America can claim more credibility than any other Western country to have at last become politically colorblind. That was the hope, anyway. But underneath the optimism roiled anxieties about the changing ethnic makeup of America, which seemed destined to become majority non-white. Antipathy towards Mr. Obama and his policies, including a massive expansion of health care coverage nicknamed Obamacare, fueled the rise of the Tea Party, a populist movement that would reshape the Republican Party. And there was not only anxiety and partisanship, but racism. Conservative media and a reality television star named Donald Trump amplified the baseless claim that Mr. Obama had not been born in America. Mr. Obama's election, then, was both a milestone in America's long struggle over race and a reminder that the struggle was far from over. The unthinkable becomes routine. 2012. In 2012, in Newtown, Connecticut, a 20-year-old man armed with a semi-automatic rifle walked into Sandy Hook Elementary School and killed 20 children, 6 adults, and himself. The murders of 6 and 7-year-olds shocked the country. Yet, despite hopes that the massacre would lead to tougher gun laws, Congress mostly offered, quote, thoughts and prayers. America's relationship with guns has made it an outlier among rich countries. It has an estimated $500 million in circulation, the overwhelming majority acquired legally. Since Sandy Hook, there have been thousands more mass shootings. Yet, in much of the country, gun laws have become more permissive. Gun rights advocates argue that most restrictions violate the Second Amendment, and this century, the Supreme Court has often agreed. In the view of the court's conservative majority, at least, the founders wanted to give the right to bear arms as much protection as the right to free speech. Someone should tweet about this. For most of American history, intermediaries such as newspapers and broadcasters controlled the flow of information. Then came the Internet. Suddenly, anyone could make themselves read, heard, or seen by millions. America, with its free speech culture and dynamic economy, led this transformation, for better and worse. American entrepreneurs built vast social media companies whose algorithms and users came to shape online discourse. Social media tilted the balance of power away from institutions and towards the public. Anyone with a phone could expose an abuse of power by posting a video online. but the platforms did not upgrade public discourse. Companies' algorithms served ever more of whatever users craved most: conspiracy theories, rage bait, titillation, cat videos. They gave strident voices more exposure than reasoned ones. The result was a more polarized political culture, one in which populist politicians flourished. The Party of Trump, 2016 to 2020. When Mr. Trump rode down a golden escalator to announce his presidential campaign in 2015, few pundits gave him much chance of winning. Even after he won the Republican nomination, polls showed him losing to Hillary Clinton, a former First Lady and Secretary of State. But Mrs. Clinton represented the establishment, and voters were in an anti-establishment mood. Mr. Trump stoked anger at elites, whom he blamed for shipping American jobs overseas. He also stoked resentment of undocumented immigrants, promising to build a wall along the southern border and make Mexico pay for it. His isolationist, nationalist, and pugilist politics appealed to voters who wanted to put, quote, America first and, quote, make America great again. Mr. Trump won the presidency and, over the course of his first term, took control of the Republican Party. He passed large tax cuts and appointed three justices to the Supreme Court, creating a 6-3 conservative majority. He also discarded or undermined establishment Republican support for free trade and alliances such as NATO. Many Americans recoiled from his inflammatory rhetoric, frequent lies, and divisive policies. Business leaders, though, liked his tax cuts and hands-off approach to regulation. The stock market boomed. The Trump presidency widened America's divisions. Loving or hating him became core to people's identity. The red MAGA hat became a totem, worn proudly by some and loathed by others. The Great Awakening. During Mr. Trump's first term, debates about sex, race, and power intensified. In 2017, investigative journalists reported that Harvey Weinstein, a prominent film producer, was alleged to have harassed, assaulted, and raped women in Hollywood. The revelations emboldened other women to speak out about similar experiences. Using the hashtag MeToo, they exposed the pervasive problem of sexual harassment in America and around the world. Powerful men lost their jobs or status, as behavior that had long been tolerated was now condemned. In 2020, George Floyd, a black man suspected of using a counterfeit $20 bill, was killed by a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, in Minneapolis. Video of Mr. Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes went viral, galvanizing a sense in society that racism and police brutality had been tolerated for too long. Millions took to the streets, protesting under the banner of, quote, Black Lives Matter. Like hashtag MeToo, the movement prompted a reckoning in American life and politics that many thought was overdue. But these and allied movements, critics said, encouraged excesses such as ideological conformity, censorship, and, in hiring and education, an emphasis on identity at the expense of merit. The Year the World Stayed Home, 2020. A new human coronavirus has appeared in China. So went our first understated report on COVID-19 in January 2020. The disease would soon spread around the world, creating the biggest public health crisis in a century. In an effort to slow it down, state and local governments imposed sweeping restrictions. For liberty-loving America, it was a lot to absorb. Public health measures quickly became polarizing, triggering resistance, especially on the right. Schools and offices closed, children lost months of classroom learning, and millions of Americans began working from home. Mr. Trump himself played down the virus and promoted dubious treatments. Still, the government spent trillions of dollars to prevent an economic collapse. It also poured money into research. Just 11 months after the virus was identified, effective vaccines were produced. It was a triumph of American science and industry, working with international partners, and somehow yet another source of polarization. Anthony Fauci, the public face of the government's response, became an object of hostility on the right. Some, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now the health secretary, questioned the safety of the vaccines. More than 1 million Americans died from COVID. The jabs are thought to have saved hundreds of thousands of American lives and millions globally. Sore loser, 2020 to 2021. Mr. Trump's handling of COVID did not inspire confidence, and the recession triggered by the pandemic left voters in a sour mood ahead of the presidential election in 2020. The virus led to changes in voting procedures. More states accepted mail-in ballots. In the end, Joe Biden, a moderate Democrat well past retirement age, triumphed. But Mr. Trump refused to concede, claiming the election had been rigged. He made up stories about vote-counting shenanigans in Democratic strongholds. He blamed mail-in ballots, election workers, and voting machines. The courts, including judges he had appointed, roundly rejected these claims. Still, he persisted in the lie, culminating in a rally on January 6, 2021, after which his supporters stormed the Capitol. The attack shocked the country. More than 140 police officers were assaulted. Members of Congress, in fear for their lives, were ushered into hiding. It was the most serious challenge to the peaceful transfer of power in modern American history. Most Republicans soon got over their shock. The Democrat-controlled House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time, but the Senate acquitted him. He remained free to run again. The return of great power competition. As America wrestled with challenges to its liberal principles at home, a new illiberal power was rising in the East. For decades, politicians had argued that as China became more integrated into global markets and international institutions, it would become more invested in the American-led world order, and ultimately more open and free. China did become the world's factory and second biggest economy. But rather than liberalize, it tried to bend the world order more to its liking. In America, concerns mounted over its growing geopolitical, economic, and military power. The first Trump administration made competition with China a central theme of its foreign policy, imposing stiff tariffs on Chinese goods. Mr. Biden's presidency solidified the government's hawkish turn. America's unipolar moment was over. A bipolar or even multipolar world was emerging. AI did not write this. When OpenAI introduced ChatGPT in 2022, artificial intelligence entered the mainstream. Suddenly, the idea that computers could display something approaching human intelligence no longer seemed like science fiction. As with other recent technological revolutions, America led the way. No other country on Earth has the genius, capital, and infrastructure necessary to dominate the field. Well, except perhaps America's rival, China. The surge in investment has boosted the American economy, but AI has also stirred anxieties. Workers worry about their jobs. National security officials are concerned about cyber attacks and disinformation. And environmentalists are alarmed by the enormous energy demands of data centers. AI has raised an old question: who should control a transformative technology? The state or a handful of rich entrepreneurs, such as Sam Altman, Dario Amodei, and Elon Musk? The concentration of such power in so few private hands poses a profound challenge to America's liberal principles. The Roberts Court. In 2022, nearly five decades after the Supreme Court found a constitutional right to abortion, it reversed itself, returning the issue to the states, many of which have since banned or sharply restricted the procedure. Under Chief Justice John Roberts, a conservative supermajority has reshaped constitutional law more thoroughly than any court since the Civil Rights era. It has expanded gun rights, redrawn the lines between church and state, in effect ended affirmative action in university admissions, and curbed the power of federal agencies, all while expanding executive power and granting broad legal immunity to presidents. But it sometimes slapped Mr. Trump down, for example, when he claimed the power to impose tariffs at will or abolish birthright citizenship. Supporters argue that these decisions uphold the Constitution as written. Critics see unelected judges making policy from the bench. The argument over the judiciary's role is almost as old as the Republic itself. Trump Unbound, 2024 to present. Capitalizing on high inflation, concerns about immigration, and short memories, Mr. Trump defeated Kamala Harris, Mr. Biden's vice president, in the race for the White House in 2024, after a faltering Mr. Biden was pressed to drop his bid for re-election. In his second term, Mr. Trump has turned the dial of Trumpiness up to 11. Instead of a trade war with China, he launched a trade war with the whole world, imposing sweeping tariffs. His immigration crackdown has prompted repeated accusations of human rights abuses, and he has proved more willing to use military force abroad than his, quote, America First rhetoric had implied. Perhaps most striking of all is the transformation of the federal government itself. Mr. Trump has blurred the line between public office and private interest through his family's business ventures. He has replaced independent officials with loyalists and used the Justice Department against political opponents. The norms and institutional checks that had once constrained presidents are eroding. The Republic, whose history we've just spent seven chapters reviewing, suddenly looks rather less settled. If you can keep it. In the year this timeline begins, not long after America declared its independence, the future of the young country was in doubt. George Washington's troops were retreating, his army close to collapse. "These are the times that try men's souls," wrote Thomas Paine. Yet Paine was not one for despair. "What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly," he said. He believed deeply in the Enlightenment ideals on which the New Republic rested, and wrote to stiffen America's resolve at a moment of genuine peril. Washington is thought to have read the words aloud to his troops. 250 years later, America is in need of another dose of Paine's resolve. The country's great liberal experiment is under strain. Politicians show little regard for many of the Enlightenment ideals the founders held dear. Americans themselves are bitterly divided, rarely agreeing on what ails the country, let alone the cures. History offers some consolation. The American experiment has faltered before and recovered. Its story has been one of setbacks as well as renewal. From the moment the framers set out, in the Constitution's opening sentence, quote, "to form a more perfect union," the country has wrestled with its imperfections. In Philadelphia in 1787, just after the Constitutional Convention adjourned, an aging Benjamin Franklin was asked, "What have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" His reply, "A republic if you can keep it." America's liberal experiment remains incomplete and contested. 2.5 centuries on, Franklin's challenge endures. That lengthy piece was the seventh and final chapter of the America at 250 series, Hope, Backlash, and the Battle for America, 2006 to present. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the July 4th to July 10th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain, plus Chapter 7 of the America at 250 series. I'm Steve Veach, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.